there. Mark at the Diabetic Show, Dolby. You'll get it. You'll get there from here. Hopefully we helped you out. If not, well.
Come back next time. We'll try again.
We'll try harder. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring the non-GMO baked goods of Angelic Bakehouse. Crafted in Cudahy, their breads, wraps, buns, and baguettes contain 7 sprouted whole grains. The market is open Saturdays from 10 until 2 in the Roadie, heading outside May 13th. This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning, and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm your host this morning, Steve Brown, and we have a really interesting show. I'll be talking with Jill Berkowitz and also Ann Myers, and they are educators who live on the East Coast. They write on a routine basis for Education Week, both commentary and blogs, and we'll be talking to them about a number of stories and blogs and commentary that they've been writing recently, and I think you'll find it very interesting. And before we do that, I did want to mention, you might recall that my last Education Matters from last month, I featured the students from Wilmot Union High School out in the western part of Kenosha County in the new village of Salem Lakes. And these were members of the Academic Decathlon team. And they had the National Academic Decathlon Finals in Madison, April 20th through the 22nd. And they placed 2nd in the nation, and they were 10th in the nation all around. And for the first time in the 36-year history of the program, Wisconsin was host for the 2017 national competition. In their 4th consecutive appearance, the state champs from Wilmot Union High School represented Wisconsin, and this was held at the Monona Terrace in Madison. There were more than 200 community volunteers who were called up to serve as proctors and judges and timers. And you might recall that we had talked with them that this year's theme was World War II. Wilmot High School placed 2nd among the Division II teams and 10th overall in the nation. And if you're counting points, well, they accumulated 42,073.3 points out of a possible 60,000 points. That team is made up of Kyle Henderson, Sean O'Dowd, Claire Vozo, Isaac Brulee, Ambriel Sigerman, Emily Heckel, Rachel Kostrova, Samantha Steiner, and Kyle Kostrova. And their team is coached by Don Sierkowski and also Caitlin Kelcher. So congratulations to everyone at Wilmot Union High School for placing number 2 in the nation in Division II and 10th overall in the United States. So hats off to them. And my guest on Education Matters now will be Jill Berkowitz, who has her doctorate. She spent 30 years in education focusing on issues of equity and best practices in curriculum, instruction, assessment, and technology. Also, Ann Myers, also a doctorate in education. She's professor emerita at Sage College, where she was founding director of the Sage Doctoral Program in Educational Leadership and of the Don Lafferty Hochsprung Center of the Promotion of Mental Health and School Safety. So I think you'll find this to be a very interesting interview that we have. And once again, this was a conference call, so they are both on the same phone using a conference speaker. So I just wanted to alert you ahead of time to that. Jill and Ann, welcome to Education Matters here on WGTD.
Good morning, Steve. It's good to be with you.
First of all, one of the things I always like to do with a guest here on Education Matters, at least the first time that I have guests on, and hopefully we can have you on again in the future. First, if we could start with Jill and then Ann, maybe if you could just give our listeners an idea of your background, where you grew up, where you went to school, high school, and then also your experiences in higher education, both as a student, and then some of the places where you work and have worked in the past. So maybe if we can start with Jill.
Okay, good morning. I grew up in Philadelphia, Long Island, New Jersey, and then finished growing up in Manhattan. I went to, because we moved so much, several schools and wound up graduating from a high school in Lawrence, Long Island. I then returned to the city and went to Hunter College at night and then moved upstate and finished at SUNY New Paltz, where I got my bachelor's and master's degree in teaching elementary and also special ed. I then taught in Sullivan County for several years. And then I went on to get my certification as an administrator and became a principal in a middle school in Poughkeepsie and stayed there for several years. And from that position, I became director of curriculum assessment and technology in that same district. At that time, after my career in public education was time for retirement, I had obtained my doctorate degree by that time from Sage College in Albany, and I became connected with the work of Ann Myers, and we together started blogging for Education Week on issues specifically relating to leadership in education. And then after that, we wrote the book, The STEM Shift, together. And so now we are supporting that work through our work in Education Week and in interviews like this. And so now I'm teaching as an adjunct professor at SUNY New Paltz, teaching teachers who have a career goal of becoming administrators.
Mm-hmm. Ann Myers, the same question for you in terms of sharing with our listeners your background and your experiences, if you would, please.
Surely. My background quite different from Jill's. I grew up on a farm in upstate New York, a very eclectic farm that had dairy cattle, and we did corn as crop, and so I grew up in a 4-H community, and that was went to a central school district, school bus ride of about 40 minutes to get to school in the morning and at the end of the day. The school that I went to was South Bend Falls Central School District, right in the foothills of the Adirondack Mountains. Upon graduation, I went to the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, which at that point in time was a private women's Catholic college. And then I got a master's from the State University of New York and a doctorate in educational leadership from Columbia University. But my first work in education was as a high school social studies teacher, first in the city of Albany and then in Columbia County, which is along the Hudson River Valley in New York State. And then I began my career in leadership and spent 3 decades as a leader, became at the end of that time a district superintendent at a intermediate school district in New York. We call them BOCES, Boards of Cooperative Educational Services. And I left that role to join the faculty at Sage College and had the honor of creating a doctoral program in educational leadership. And I'm currently professor emeritus from that program. Along the way, I became involved with the Center for Courage and Renewal in Seattle, and part of the consulting work that I do these days is with that center on a program called Leading Together, Building Adult Communities in Schools. And so that work and our writing and consulting about STEM keeps me pretty busy these days.
As we prepared for our interview, I was talking about some of the things that the two of you write on an ongoing basis in Education Week. And for our listeners, if you go to edweek.org, and I've referred many times on Education Matters some of the people I've interviewed, a number of articles and topics, but I was just looking at the one that was posted yesterday on edweek.org. It's blogs.edweek.org, and the title is Why Schools Build Business and Higher Education Partnerships, and that's a little different from what we were just talking about, but I was noticing that in the first paragraph and one of the bullet points, it's actually the first bullet point, where it talks about the beginning of the paragraph says, one of the facets 21st century schools have in common when in partnerships with business and higher education, many schools and districts already have partnerships that can be maximized with a willingness to recognize that, and this is the point I want to make, students continue to fail to see a connection between what is happening in their classrooms and their future lives. And some of the things that both of you were just talking about, it seems like the individuals that you were just talking about, Mrs. Long, Mrs. Gaines, your principal, that they were able to help you form these connections, if you will. I guess my first question is are we doing enough in our public schools today with respect to helping students find that connection between what's happening in school on a day-to-day basis and how that relates on an ongoing basis in their future lives?
No.
Okay. Okay.
and the answer is, there are individual teachers and perhaps in subject areas that are connecting to students in that way, but it is not a foundational part of what we're doing in public education. We have built a system around teaching subjects with implied value, measured by a testing system. And there are children who are falling away every day because they're not seeing the relevancy of that content in their lives.
And, you know, I certainly support and agree with Anne. Even more specifically, I think that any parent, any teacher has heard of students say, I don't know why I need to learn this. We've actually heard it from adults who said, I don't understand why I needed to learn, you know, geometry, or I don't understand why it's important for me to understand history. And so that it's the training of our teachers that needs to be addressed. And I think it's the need to welcome those professionals in the field who are actually using the material that we're teaching in such a separated, segregated way so that students can actually apply what they're learning and get the understanding at the same time, seeing where the potential for these subjects in working with these experts can lead them for their career. So mm-hmm. it kind of embeds career study and, learning about careers and what you're good at and what you want to be interested in. It's all connected through a real experience, and we've seen it in the research we did for the book. Every school that was using a partner, a business partner, to help relate and work with the students and the teachers resulted in professional development for the teachers, so that the teachers have an opportunity to see what they're teaching applied in the real world, and an opportunity for the students to be working with people who are beyond their teachers, you know, who become kind of like their parent in a way for the year, to work with professionals who can give me feedback as a student on the work that I'm doing and how it relates to what they're doing in the bigger world.
Mm-hmm. You know, as both of you were talking about your backgrounds, and both of you having the experiences in higher education, as I do, I mean, I've been a classroom teacher, a school principal, a district-level administrator. I've taught at the university level in both undergrad teacher ed and in school administration, educational leadership for well over 20 years in higher ed. The second bullet point, I think, is a fascinating one in this latest article. And you said that teachers do not have experience working in the fields of their content area. And I want you to comment on that, because our coverage area here for WGTD, we have the University of Wisconsin Parkside that has an excellent program in teacher preparation. We have Carthage College, which is a private college, and certainly the UW system. But this idea that teachers, based on your comment and your article in your latest blog, that teachers do not have experience working in the fields of their content area. Maybe if you can expand on that and maybe talk about why that is so important. And then from that, I want to talk about STEM, about science, technology, engineering and math. But why is it important that teachers have actual experience working in their content area in which they're teaching?
Well, we prepare teachers similarly to the way that they were prepared in generations past. We want to be sure that teachers in each subject know not only the content of what they're teaching, but the manner in which children learn. So it's important to make a distinction between the two. So how students learn and how teaching needs to take place to come to a positive, a successful result is important. What has changed not only is the workforce and what is expected of the workforce, not only has that changed, but our learners have changed. We have children who can actually go to YouTube and learn how to do things that, before we never had the opportunity or the facility to do that before. So children are more exposed to more information. They have more access to information. And yet we're still teaching them in much the same way. An example is your traditional high school is 40 or 42-minute periods with separate subjects. And there are some places that have taken the step to do interdisciplinary work or project-based learning. But the truth is that if you come up with a problem or a project for a student to do, it's quite different if it's developed even by a knowing teacher than it is if it's developed by a professional. So, for example, a scientist in working in conjunction with the science department in the school we referred to, Stratford STEM Magnet High School, can actually bring real research, real problems that they're dealing with into the classroom and moderate it with the teacher. So that what happens is what I had was explaining before. What happens is students are now engaged in real problems, asking to be contributors to solutions to real problems. And so that the professional can manage the content while the teacher manages the teaching and learning environment, the needs of differentiation for the different students who have different specific needs, and so that at the end, for those that are concerned about standards being met, the teacher can make sure that there's alignment and that nothing is being left out. But children are involved in real problem solving, which is motivational, and which people complain about all the time. Kids aren't, you know, motivated and engaged. It engages them. It makes them feel seen and heard and important, and they can learn much better. You know, we saw that as we looked at the schools that we did for our research for the book.
Have we in teacher education and in colleges or schools of education here in this country, have we actually changed how we train teachers now based on everything that you've been talking about, or are we doing things the same way because we run our schools the same way as Horace Mann talked about in the 1840s? We still have students always start school in August and the end of May or June because all the students, obviously, which is not true, you know, have to go out into the fields and on their family farms. And we have a lot of family farms here in Wisconsin, as you have in upstate New York and all over the country, and family farms are great. But our schools are still being run the same way as they were 150 years ago.
Yes, Steve. And you will find, as Jill and I write, that that's a major theme for us. We are people who walk into schools today who might have attended schools 25, 30, 40 years ago will recognize everything. But if you were to walk into a manufacturing plant or a pharmaceutical company, nothing would look the same. And we are, in one way, preservationists. And that's part of our role in this country, is to keep the values and the history of the country alive. But that has outweighed our ability to become current change agents and to keep pace with the rest of the society. I would go back to your question about why do teachers need that experience in the field? And say for two reasons. One is many people who become teachers do so because they love a content area or a particular age of children. And they're wonderful teachers in that regard. But for kids today who are entering such a digital world, where opportunities are much more vast than what is within the 20-mile radius of their home, they need to have a sense of how the content area can become relevant for what they see in their future. Otherwise, there's no connection to it other than the reinforcement of what the grade at the end of the course is going to be. And the other thing I would say is that teachers themselves get stimulation as they experience working alongside people who are professionals in their field. It is energizing for the faculty, and that's part of the place from which creativity arises, and we need to allow teachers to have those creative spaces again.
Let's shift, if we could, over to STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And I want to talk about your book, STEM Shift, and the commentary that the two of you wrote back in September of 2015. The title in Education Week is STEM Should Broaden, Not Narrow the Curriculum. And one of the things you write, you say that STEM offers a broadening of possibilities for learning. The schools and leaders we learned from while doing research for our book, The STEM Shift, were not creating a narrower focus. Maybe if you could elaborate on that, and then also maybe just at the front end of that question, or your answer rather, maybe how the two of you got involved with STEM and why that is so important in today's education.
I'll pick up the first part of that.
Okay.
I was a history teacher. Jill was a special ed teacher. So we were not STEM content area teachers. I was introduced to what STEM can be by teachers in the Metro Nashville public schools. I was working with their first year of the establishment of their STEM magnet schools that were K-12 in that district. And the leadership in Metro Nashville believed that as they were creating the new STEM schools, they also needed to be attending the new relationships that adults would need to have in schools where teaching and learning was cross-disciplinary, interdisciplinary. And so while I was working on that relational part of the program with the teachers, they were teaching me what STEM meant. And I learned from them that STEM was much more than four specific content areas. It was a change in teaching and learning, and it was the dynamic interaction among content areas that really made something STEM. And then I'll turn this over to Jill.
So the thing about STEM right now is that people are attached to the name, understandably, science, technology, engineering, and math. And here's why they're the most important things to consider as we're looking at schools moving forward in this, you know, we're 17 years into the century already. These four subjects are in service of each other. They don't, science does not exist now without mathematics, without technology. Engineering doesn't exist without mathematics and technology. And in order for them to, in their application, in order for them to work, there are four essentials that are required. Collaboration, communication, creative thinking, and critical thinking. Those four as the foundation of how science, technology, engineering, and math are taught gives a frame of reference for how everything else fits. So, for example, there is now a subject considered called Art Sci, and an author named Arthur I. Miller wrote a book about how art and science are colliding. The book is called Colliding Worlds. And so when you think about what they're looking at as we're uncovering DNA and we're looking at atoms, the artistic representation and how they look in photography and how that expresses and communicates is essential. So you can't really have science, technology, engineering, and math without the arts. But you also can't have it without an understanding of history. For example, now I guess there's a movie coming out from a great book called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, where were we as human beings and as you know, moral beings as we were using this woman's you know, body to do research and save other lives. So the moral history of our nation, the ethical application of scientific research, all has to do with history. You know, when you look at medical advancements and how they all exploded during wartime, was because risks needed to be taken in order to save lives that were coming under unusual physical challenges. So history, English, literature, context, morals, art, all have a role in the development around these four or five subjects and need to be the way we look at our graduates in terms of what they know and are able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So because our economy is based really in these four subjects moving forward, we need to be able to prepare students to be able to enter that economy on many levels, whether they are the lead scientists in research or whether they are one of the lab people, you know, doing the counting of the number of something.
Mm-hmm.
They all need to have that understanding, and STEM is the root.
Related to that, back in on April 6th, which is you turned over your blog over to Dr. Myers, J.M. Myers, who's a medical doctor, and the title caught my eye, and the title is Schools Need More Reliable Research. And so that kind of leads me to my next question. Do you think that we are doing enough research in the area of how effective incorporating STEM into our school curriculum?
Great question. There's two. I'm thinking that there are two answers. One problem that we have is that it's early and that we don't have a large enough sample,
mm-hmm.
that there are some sophisticated, courageous superintendents that have made a commitment to bring their districts forward. In collaboration with that, they have to be answerable to state requirements for standardized tests. And standardized tests are designed to measure content knowledge. And so in order to be able to guarantee that this content knowledge is attained while developing these programs is quite a challenge. Those people, those leaders that we saw doing district-level shifting were willing and were able to convince their communities to let them make these shifts, and that they had confidence that their grades, their standardized test grades, will not falter. As a matter of fact, they will be strong.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really still at the very beginning of this level, and we do not have the data.
There's also the issue of multiple definitions of what STEM is. I mean, there are those who hold that STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. There are those that hold that it is those four areas plus the arts, and so they have STEAM programs.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are those, like Jill and myself, who say this is a different way of teaching and learning. It is a different way of organizing schools. It is a different way of presenting material, engaging students. And so there, any research that is going on may not be about the same thing, but it might use the same language. That's one of the problems with the research. Another one is that we don't have good research about children and how children learn. And certainly a lot of that is changing in terms of the infusion of technology, and yet we're not keeping pace with it because we don't have a lot of good research. And there are many, many reasons for that. But we kind of find our way as we go. and we don't have data and support the very best things that are happening in a way that allows us to make the best decisions we can.
Mm-hmm. Let's do a quick shift, if I can play off the title of your book, The STEM Shift. Let's do a shift, a totally different shift of topics. The article the April 11th blog that the two of you wrote, Four Lessons for Leaders from Children. In fact, I talked about this last night in my school law class, by the way, that I taught at UW Oshkosh. I found it fascinating. I played one of the audio clips from it. How did you come up with this as a topic? And then maybe if you could share with our listeners, because we have about another 5 minutes or so, and then I have a Betsy DeVos question for you at the end here, and then a wrap-up. But how did you come up with this as a topic for your blog? Because it's sort of different from some of the other topics. And what are some of the and what were the four lessons from children for the leaders?
See, the blog arose from a lot of hard-to-bear news, Steve, and an assessment, looking around and seeing where we were and seeing where the world is extinguishing lights rather than igniting them. And in the midst of that, the Internet began introducing children's stories, and they were not coming, of course, all at once. One came from Britain, and then 10 days later, one came from Kentucky. But all of a sudden, after about a month of that, in a reflective moment, taking a pause and saying, you know, there's a constellation out here, and if we listen to this, these children are really teaching us lessons and giving us hope. And it was from that source that the blog was written.
When you wrote those four lessons, I would assume that there were probably 30 or 40 lessons, and you had to synthesize them down to four. Maybe if you could read what those four lessons are from the children for leaders.
Sure. The first lesson actually is the one that came directly from Brooke Blair. It was, overlook no one, we all matter. The second one was, let us be uniquely who we are. The third one, help us joyfully see beyond the limitations that might be placed on us. And the final one was, if leaders are creating the world of the next generation, make it be one inspired by the voices of these children. It is a source of hope, and it is pouring forth exactly when we need it.
Mm-hmm. As the two of you were writing this particular blog, what were some of your own inner thoughts as you were doing it? Because obviously, you know, this blog was very different than the others that you've written.
Yes, Steve. And so let me just kind of, with a smile on my face, talk to you about the difference in process in terms of how Jill and I write. Jill writes very spontaneously and very profusely. I carry things in my head for weeks and then sit down and put it on paper. Our styles are very different, and yet every time we co-write, each of us touches every piece. So it's a rapport that we have developed over years together. So yes, this piece is very different, and it's because it was germinating. It took germination time, and we gave it that space. We gave it the space to say, if the children were talking to us, if we could be translators from the 4- and 5-year-old to the leadership world in which we live and work,
how would we translate them? And so we kind of learned the language of the children through watching those videos, and then we attempted to synthesize them and apply it to leaders.
Mm-hmm. And my last question, in wrapping up our conversation now, if both of you could say something right now to our current Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, what might that be?
This is Ann, and I would say to her, public schools are valuable, and they're worth saving, and they're worth investment, because they are holding the future.
And in support of that, this is Jill, I would say that I would urge her to not do anything or change anything until she has been not in the shining schools or just the good places, but for her to see and understand what schools that are dealing with children in poverty are like, what rural schools are like, to sit down and speak with people about understanding the effect of what it is she thinks is going to solve the world's problems in schools. So I would urge her to stop moving forward and start going into the field and learning more about what she is now in charge of.
Can I add one thing?
Sure.
I've had a moment to think.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would also invite her to challenge our thinking, but be supportive of our work. Because I think it is probably that exchange that could allow us to bridge some major gaps.
Well, I want to thank both Ann Myers and Jill Berkowitz for joining me for these 45 minutes here on Education Matters. And before we close Education Matters today, I wanted you to hear just this brief audio clip from Brooke Blair. 5 years old, she lives outside of London, and she spoke to the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Theresa May. Actually, it was a YouTube video. She wanted the Prime Minister to know about the homeless people and that they needed to be taken care of. And this relates to one of the four lessons for leaders for children or from children that we heard from both Anne and from Jill. And this is the one that says, overlook no one, we all matter. And now here is Brooke Blair.
Look, my name is Brooke Blair and I'm 5 years old. I've got something to say to you, Theresa May. Yesterday night, I was out in the streets and I saw 100 million of homeless people. I saw one with 4 years, I saw loads. You should be out there, Theresa May. You should be biscuits, hot chocolate sandwiches, building houses. Look, I'm only 5 years old. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm saving up money and there'll never be enough. You've got the pot of money. Spend some and help people. That's what you've got to do. Because we've had lots of wars in this country and I do not like that, Theresa May. I'm very angry.
That was young Brooke Blair, who lives just outside of London. With her fierce little voice and great hand gestures, you can see her video on YouTube. And she caused us to recall just how easy it is to overlook what it is in front of us and accept things rather than push for change when we need it. For Education Matters, here on WGTD-HD, I'm your host, Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
And good morning. I'm Jim McClure, your host this week for Community Matters. And our topic is going to be one that's not only relevant to